Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast with more ambition, drive, dynamism, excitement, intent, and overall joy than the England football team. I got that off my chest. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, as ever to discuss all things sport, is Mr. Will Moulton.
Hello. Given that the Premier League had come back, I'd actually forgotten about those England performances, so thanks for reminding me.
I remember them very well, because I had to cover both of them. I've never had to struggle not to fall asleep so much in my life.
I don't know why I didn't decide to just watch the Scotland game instead, because that would have been more interesting.
I had that on a smaller screen. I was keeping one eye. But hey-ho. If you are new to the podcast, in the first half, myself and Will will go through some of the most important sporting topics in the last 2 weeks. On this episode's discussion section, we're going to go through the forever scandalous, corrupt and human rights abusing 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. Before we talk about the climate of fear that has shed a terrible light on British swimming this week. The second half of every podcast episode is our feature interview section, where myself or Will hold an in-depth one-on-one interview with a star from the sporting world. On this episode, we are joined by Jack Rutter, the captain of the England Cerebral Palsy football team. He talks about the proud journey he has been on and also how he bounced back in the face of adversity when his promising professional career was taken away from him on a fateful light-changing night. All that and more on this episode of the Sportspiel. On to the first topic, and that is the Qatar 2022 FIFA World Cup, a tournament that was already drowning in corruption and scandal. Of course, we all know the tenuous circumstances in which the Gulf State was awarded the World Cup and had eventually kick-started the cleanup of the corrupt entity that is FIFA. A weak and timid cleanup, but a cleanup nonetheless. Now, myself and Will have elected to talk about this topic in this episode after Jonathan Liu, the new chief sports writer at The Independent, wrote an article on October the 3rd entitled World Cup 2022, Qatar's workers are not workers, they are slaves. And they are building mausoleums, not stadiums. And first off, it was quite an incredible article, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was thought-provoking, that's for certain. There was some strong opinions voiced from Jonathan, but I think, fair enough. It's a contentious topic. He's a journalist, he's allowed to have his say, and I think he made a lot of very good points, and he's put them across in a good way where it's not going to be scandalous. It's just a reflection of what he thinks is the truth, and definitely caught my attention when I read it.
Absolutely. If you haven't read it, I urge you to, but for some sort of context for our next point, I'm going to read the first four parts. Your name is Sumon, and you live in a small village in rural Bangladesh. One day you're visited by a casual acquaintance you've known since childhood, who has an opportunity. He's recruiting for a clerical job. He knows you've always been bright and ambitious, and he wants you. He'll take care of everything: paperwork, passport, medical transport. He'll even act as a reference if you need a bank loan. The promised salary, which is $400 a month, is literally more money than you've seen before in your life. So you sign. There's a small recruitment fee to be paid, plus the cost of your orientation, seminar, medical examination, insurance. You sell some land, empty your savings, lean on your extended family for support, and borrow the rest against future earnings. It's a big life-changing step, but with your handsome salary, you reckon you'll be able to break even and start sending money home within a few months. You're doing this so your children won't have to. Alas, when you land in Doha, the goalposts have shifted slightly. This much becomes apparent when you're handed a helmet and a high-vis jacket and told to present yourself at a building site at 6 a.m. the following morning. You're not working as a clerk in an office, you're building a football stadium. They're not quite sure who told you the $400 a month figure, but it's actually going to be $200. The recruitment fee isn't $200 as you'd agreed, but $2,000 plus the cost of your flight to Qatar. Your crisp new passport is confiscated, you cannot quit your job, you cannot leave the country. And before you've even clocked in for your first shift, you owe your employer the equivalent of 2 years' wages. Now, Sumon, as Jonathan Liu says in the article, doesn't actually exist. But he says he created this character to put a human face on what is going on in Qatar. Did that sort of hit home, and do you think that helps highlight the problem more than other reports have in the past?
Yeah, it certainly stirs the emotions, that piece. I think for me, and I don't know how you felt, as someone who's, we've obviously trained as journalists, it's sometimes you have to almost look past that, and I just feel like that's his opinion of how stuff works, because my uncle Spent 3.5 years working in Qatar, not in a football stadium, but with an oil company. And obviously he was a Westerner, so he was treated fairly well. And he was working with a big company. But he had a lot of migrant workers working underneath him, and they weren't treated as badly as that suggests. But that was a completely different industry altogether. We don't really know what's going on, so we've got to assume that there's some truth in what he said, I think.
Exactly. I mean, industry could certainly come into it. And I would think there's an Amnesty International report that I read that dates back a couple of years ago that essentially says the workers on the World Cup stadiums are working in humidity and heat that is far beyond what they can cope with and are kind of dropping dead, really. But there's no way of telling because there's no statistics that come out from the authorities. There's no post-mortems carried out. And there's just no way of telling for certain how much and how bad the situation actually is.
Well, the Human Rights Watch charity went into Qatar and released a conditions report at the end of last month, earlier this month, and found that, same again, there's poor regulations on working conditions and hundreds are dropping dead every year, but they're not sure why. They're not getting proper burials. The families really aren't being told anything or getting a payoff. So this is a story that's been coming up time and time again, and I think the fact that it keeps coming up, it means that definitely something very bad is going on in Qatar.
Even if you look away from the deaths, this is one thing I found quite striking, is that family zones, public spaces over in Qatar, which are kind of, you know, shopping centres, things like that. And you'd expect, even when workers have day offs, they could go to some of these places, but they're actually barred from going to these, quote, family zones. They're reserved for rich Qataris and Westerners on holiday. Something else I found quite amazing.
Definitely, and Jonathan Liu makes a quote in the piece, and he says, the 2022 World Cup is a tournament being built on a graveyard of human bodies to prop up a society founded upon the most basic type of racism. And when you look at it like that, in terms of certain migrant workers from certain countries are being banned from the family zones and that, then that is effectively racism, isn't it?
Racism, slavery, all in one.
We're allowing them to get away with it?
At the moment. Or could there be a twist in the tail? Because this is when we come on to the second thing that's kind of hitting Qatar right now. Because the country is also going through a political crisis with the rival Middle Eastern countries Bahrain, Egypt, Saudi Arabia and the UAE cutting ties with the Qataris. And they've blockaded the state, accusing it of supporting terrorism and sowing discord in the region. Those countries have said that they will lift those sanctions if Qatar give up the World Cup. Now, this week, Qatar hit back and said the efforts to strip them of the tournament was petty jealousy and a threat to their independence. Is it petty jealousy?
It's a funny one, because there's a couple of countries in there who themselves are associated with funding terrorism. Maybe not through the state, but through certain individuals. Is it petty jealousy? I don't know.
I don't think it's petty jealousy somehow, but when I look at, say, Saudi Arabia and their human rights record and what they're doing in Yemen at the moment, a little bit of double standards, I say, to put it mildly. But, next question, do you think the current crisis will have any impact whatsoever on whether the World Cup is staged in Qatar?
In an ideal world, then it definitely should do. In reality, not entirely sure. There's obviously a lot of questions surrounding how Qatar got the World Cup in the first place, regarding FIFA, and FIFA have made their decision now and probably have certain benefits. And actually read that the FA could potentially be getting monetary benefits from having the World Cup hosted in Qatar. But again, is it really worth it? Like, do we want our grassroots system to be propped up by a World Cup that is built on such questionable circumstances? FIFA as well, it was a short column, but Marina Hyde put an opinion column in The Guardian earlier this week and said this could be sort of the first time FIFA has found itself out of its depth. And I think with the whole sort of blockade going on and everything, that FIFA are out of their depth. So I think, honestly, anything could still happen. And in 5 years, you know, we've seen with the 2022 Commonwealth Games, that's been stripped away from South Africa. And, you know, you've already got countries bidding to host it. And I think if you were to take the World Cup away from Qatar now, there would be countries who would be able to host it with just given 5 years' notice. I mean, I'm sure we could, or Germany, or Italy, or France, or, I don't know, potentially even Brazil or somewhere like that again. So I think genuinely anything could still happen.
That's the thing. If anything is going to strip Qatar of the World Cup, it's probably going to be this crisis, because money talks, as we've so often seen in the past. Rather interestingly as well, this week, I think it was Friday, the Paris Saint-Germain chairman, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, who of course is Qatari, and the sports broadcaster BeIN, who hire famous broadcasters Richard Keys and Andy Gray, fond memories. Both, they're again a Qatari broadcaster, but both of those were accused of criminally bribing former FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valcke to buy TV rights to the World Cup. So that's another example of Qatari influence in football right now, with Paris Saint-Germain and Neymar. So the Qatari influence stretches far and wide. You mentioned the FA. Really, it's a question of morals over money, of whether the World Cup is staged in Qatar. And like you say, anything can happen because there's still 5 years to go. But my head says it will still be a Qatar 2022 World Cup.
You never know, the world could have ended by then anyway, so...
Trump mania. Anyway, we'll draw that discussion to a conclusion and move on to topic number two, which rather coincidentally comes off the back of your own article on the Sports Bill website on whether British sport had ever been in a greater state of disarray, and you may have to update it after this week. That is because British swimming have now thrown their hat into the ring for most calamitous governing body. On Thursday, October the 12th, the organisation apologised to Paralympic athletes after it was found that a former head coach had created a climate of fear. An independent inquiry found that 13 Paralympic swimmers and their families had faced unacceptable behaviours. The coach in question is believed to be Rob Greenwood, according to the BBC, and he was found to have been verbally abusive and used derogatory terms to describe athletes. The head coach is no longer in place, but a second member of staff was disciplined and remains in post. First off, what did you make of the findings, and was it the right outcome in the end?
It's worrying that there's, you know, allegations of bullying and shouting, aggression towards athletes. The apology, I think, was the minimum they could have done. They're now talking about plans to commit to a robust action plan to make sure transparent procedures are followed to and adhered to. So that's all good from sort of the outset. Let's just hope they stick to that. And obviously, with the coach, he's actually left now. So obviously they can't really do anything disciplinary against him. The other one's still working there. Maybe a little bit questionable, but I think the allegations against that individual were not so severe.
I think that was more of a mismanagement type incompetency.
Yeah, so let's hope that lessons have been learned. And from the outset, it seems like they've sort of done the right thing. They've come out and apologised. They've promised to change. It's just now a case of whether they actually stick to it or not, I think.
And you mentioned before we started recording that all of the abuse... the timescale was just before the Rio Paralympics. So kind of we were asking, what's changed then that's kind of kick-started this climate of fear?
Yeah, it was interesting. One of the Rio Paralympians talked anonymously and said that it began a year before Rio, but he'd been in the post since 2013. And he'd been okay for the first 2 years. So what did change? And potentially, you know, there could have been maybe some pressure from officials to, you know, get medals. And then he sort of took that out on the athletes. And it was interesting to feel what they said, what the Paralympians said. They said it's good that it's now been recognised, but it also feels as if members of staff would talk down to the swimmers, make us feel pathetic and useless. We were traumatised and belittled. It began a year before Rio and carried on constantly. So it'd be... You know, why all of a sudden that changed? That'd be good for us as the public to know, and for other national governing bodies, so, you know, we can almost, as I said in the the piece last week, and we need to make these changes. The athletes need to be seen as humans as well as athletes, and there needs to be these transparent procedures in place so that if athletes are feeling belittled by a coach, they can go and talk to someone rather than sort of have it all blown up in the public, which this one wasn't to an extent, but we have seen in cycling and bobsleigh, it has become a bit more of a public issue and it's not been managed very well. So let's see what happens, I guess.
That brings me on to the wider talking point, which comes down to medal success. We've seen with UK sport, they pick and allocate their funding dependent on which sports have the best chances of medal success at competitions. And Gail Emms, former badminton player, she gave an interview to The Guardian this week, and she said that this medal table obsession is unhealthy. Do we need to take a step back and get enjoyment in sport again? And she also, I think, led off with that while she was playing badminton, she kind of lost herself, lost what it meant to be herself, because it wasn't a fun atmosphere to be in. Is that where we are now, that we're so obsessed with tallies and quantifiable medals that we've kind of forgotten that these are people?
It's now working with a national governing body, it's interesting to see how much of an influence money has in terms of, as a sport, you're not going to get people playing at the top level and having fun at the top level if you haven't got the money. So it is about tallies, and it's a vicious cycle, really. I know is in hockey, we're now looking to try and move away from just being funded by UK Sport and bring in our own funding, but not everyone has the opportunity to do that. There are sports, you know, like badminton, you're not going to get that much money from sales of tickets and sponsorship and stuff like that, so they are going to have to rely on that, and swimming potentially as well. And yeah, I think some sort of cultural change needs to happen in terms of the coaches. It's almost like up to the executives and the directors to bring in the money and ensure that there are plans in place, but the coaches need to not be put under pressure to achieve those targets, but need to make the athletes perform to their best. And it was interesting, the unnamed Rio Paralympic swimmer said they did really well at Rio. They brought back 46 medals, 13 goals to 8 world records or something ridiculous like that. But they said if that climate of fear hadn't been created, they would have done even more. They would have done even better. So it's finding that balance of, okay, we need to push our athletes to achieve these medals, but we also need to remember they're humans. We want them to have fun and enjoy what they do.
That's the thing, because you're never going to do anything, I think, to your best of your abilities if you're under such severe pressure, because it's going to play on your mind when it comes to game day, as it were. So, and I do wonder if UK Sport should perhaps reevaluate their criteria and have a all-round sort of growing from the grassroots up type funding, rather than straight out bring us back the shiny pieces of metal.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if they do that. I don't know if they will.
We shall see. A lot of criticisms coming their way. We'll see if it makes any difference. But that concludes the first half of this episode of Sportspiel. But stick around, because we have an inspiring feature interview coming up. Jack Rutter was a promising up-and-coming footballer at Birmingham City with the world at his feet. However, his life and career completely changed on one fateful night. Find out why and how he bounced back with pride after this. Welcome back, everyone, to the feature interview segment, where we are joined by a truly inspiring guest. Jack Rutter is the captain of the England Cerebral Palsy football team, runs his own skills school, and also delivers workshops and motivational speeches. As an 18-year-old, he signed for Birmingham City as a promising youth prospect, but his life completely changed in an incident in March 2009. We will go into the story in more detail in just a moment, but for now, a very warm welcome to the show, Jack. How are you?
I'm very well, how are you?
Very good, thanks, very good. So let's start, I suppose, right at the beginning and talk about the sport of football itself, because it's obviously a hugely popular sport in this country. But regarding yourself, who or what kind of inspired you when you were growing up, and what made you want to become a footballer?
I sort of remember just watching football on the TV from a young age, in sort of the early 90s. So I was born in 1990, so it's about 1994, 1995, and the Premier League was starting to start. I believe, and I remember seeing like Eric Cantona on the TV playing for Manchester United, and I don't know what it was about him, but he had this aura. He had he had this like sort of presence. He put his collar up. He scored amazing goals. He scored goals when it really mattered. And I just thought, I really want to be like him and sort of entertain people. And he just looked like he was enjoying himself. And Man United at the time, I think, were dominating. So I thought, I'd support Manchester United. And I thought, I wanted to play like Eric Cantona. So that just inspired me to first of all ask my mum and dad for a Man United shirt and a football for Christmas. I didn't get the Man United shirt, but I got the football. And I made sure that I practiced with that football as much as possible to try and be the next Eric Cantona.
Yeah, he certainly had that swagger that kind of captivated a lot of imaginations, didn't he? So obviously, practicing with a football day in, day out, and obviously a big achievement comes your way when you signed for Birmingham City. It was a huge step forward in making it as a professional. Was there a real sense of pride for you once you'd signed on for the club and that this was, you know, a real stepping stone to becoming a professional?
Without a doubt. I mean, some great footballers, young players I played with at school and at county level, never actually managed to sign for a professional team. So for me to be able to sign for, first of all, I think it was Bristol Rovers when I was 8, Cardiff City when I was 9, and I signed for Birmingham City when I was 10. And obviously they were just going to the Premier League then and had the great facility, really good coaching staff. I think Sir Trevor Francis was the manager at the time. And the standard was just unbelievable. My first game I think I played as a signed player was against Manchester United at Carrington. And I just saw the level of the players that we have in this country was truly amazing. And I thought, right, that's how good I've got to be if I'm going to make it as a professional footballer. So it sort of woke me up a little bit to realise how much I need to train, how much I need to improve. But to be involved with a professional team from so, so young, it stood me in good stead for the future because I was getting unbelievable coaching, playing on really good pitches and playing against the likes of Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester United, Aston Villa in a local derby. Always loved them ones as well. From a very, very young age. So it was a dream come true to sign such an amazing club at such a young age.
And I suppose some of the first team players around there at the time, I think Matt Upson was there and David Dunn was there. What did you pick up or learn off of them as well?
They were two that stood out for me. Matt Upson was obviously a superb centre-half, ended up playing for England. And he was just so calm on the ball. And I think he was one of the first centre-halves in this country who actually brought the ball out from the back, was very calm playing it out from the back, more of a European sort of style. And that's what I've noticed about him a lot. With David Dunn, he's just hilarious around the training ground, just pulling pranks, always laughing, always joking. But he's a real talisman for Birmingham City. So I really liked being in and around him and watching what he did. And also Mikael Forsell, centre-forward. Just his attention to detail. Every single day after training, he'd be doing 20 finishes, left foot, right foot. And it was no surprise to me that he was banging the goals in the Premier League for a few years when Birmingham City probably enjoyed their best spell under Steve Bruce for a number of years. So those are the three players who I looked across to the first team and I was like, I really want to get on that first team pitch at some stage and play with players like that because they're an inspiration to me.
Absolutely. And now I come to March 22nd, 2009, and that's the day your life effectively changed. Just take us through what happened on that night.
Okay, yeah, so it's over 8 years ago now, so it's quite a while ago now, but just to set the scene, I've just obviously played in the quarter-final of the FA Youth Cup for Birmingham City, so we just reached the semi-final, and it was about 3 or 4 weeks away from our game against Liverpool, where one leg would have been at Anfield, the other at St Andrews, in one of the biggest youth competitions in the world. I'm playing right back, I'm doing really well, I'm playing for the reserve team every week, training the first team on the odd occasion, so I finally got onto that first team pitch, so I was doing really, really well, and I think, you know, a professional contract was there for me. But unfortunately, I went out on a night out with my friends, and at the end of the night, I went to talk to an old friend of mine I used to play football with when I was very young, 10 years old. And when I've turned around, unfortunately, I've got caught up in an unprovoked assault, and when the lads punched me in the head, he's knocked me unconscious, so I didn't put my hands out or anything to protect myself. I just fell straight back, and then smacked my head on the curbstone. Well, I was then rushed to Frensley Hospital in Bristol, where I spent 2-3 weeks in intensive care because I'd actually, from one punch and hit him head on the curb, fractured my skull in two places, suffered moderate brain damage, a bleed on the brain, and I was made permanently deaf in my right ear. So I actually ended up leaving hospital in a wheelchair because my balance and my coordination was so, so bad. My memory was really bad. I didn't remember what happened. I had to be told what happened. Everything was just really affected. I just felt like my whole life was over. through one act of mindless violence. So it was very, very tough at that point.
Yeah, you mentioned kind of the physical damage there as well, but was perhaps maybe the biggest problem was the mental damage that had done. The anger, I presume, could have taken over, that your dream had kind of been taken away.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, I ended up retiring from professional football just over a year after the assault because, obviously, my physical injuries, you know, my coordination and balance. But it was actually the problems with my mental state that was a long-term effect in many ways, because I was obviously depressed about what happened. I was anxious about my future. And I was obviously very, very angry about the injustice of it all. So it was very, very hard to come to terms with. And also, like I said, as well, my memory was terrible. I had problems with my fatigue, so I was getting tired really easily. I couldn't do what I could do before. It was almost going like back to a baby. I had to sort of teach myself to do things again, teach myself to talk properly. I'd always forget words when I was talking. I used to slur my speech a little bit. And obviously the physical impairments, dizziness and headaches. And it was just terrible for quite a while. And I really, at that point, didn't know how I was going to get out of it. But fortunately, I had an amazing support network from my family and friends, and a charity called Headway were instrumental in my recovery as well.
And that brings me on perfectly to CP football, effectively, which I suppose gave you that focus to really pull you out of that depression. How did you discover it, and how did playing football again, you know, at a competitive level, kind of help you recover?
Oh, immensely. I remember sitting in that office in Headway in Nottingham where I was getting a little bit of help, and I said, I'd stopped playing football at that point. I played a little bit after I retired and stuff, local level, not great. Played a bit at university where I did notice I started to get a little bit better from my injuries, but nothing outstanding or anything. But one day I was sat in the office in Headway, and I just said, is there any disability football I can play? I tried to find out before, but I'd got no luck. And they rang up the Nottinghamshire Football Association, and they said, because I'd suffered a brain injury, I could potentially qualify for the cerebral palsy team, because it's open for people with acquired brain injuries as well, not just people who have brain injuries from birth. So I went to Nottingham College, and I trained with the East Midlands Regional Cerebral Palsy Team, met the lads, and they were just so inspiring. They had far more of an impairment than I did, but they were there playing. They were wearing the East Midlands badge with pride. The coaching sessions by Liam and Pete, the coaches there, were fun and engaging. And I thought, well, I may as well give this a go. And then they looked at my medical records and they were like, well, you can definitely play. You've had a serious brain injury. You just obviously, you know football. You're still pretty mobile. So just see what comes of it. And I started doing well with the regional team there in a few tournaments. And unfortunately, it was too late for me to join the England team in 2012 for the Paralympics. But as soon as the Paralympics ended in London, I got a phone call the next day from Jeff Davis, who runs disability football really at the Football Association. And he said, Jack, we've seen you play a little bit. We know about your background. We want to give you a chance to play for your country. And it's up to you to take it. And I was like, wow, I could not believe it. I didn't think it was going to come that quick. Obviously, I remember being quite emotional when I got the phone call. But I thought, this is my second chance now. So I just thought I'm going to train, do all the things I did as a kid. And hopefully I'll take that opportunity. And fortunately, I have done.
Absolutely. And I suppose with this new venture, is the anger of what happened before kind of gone, it's in the past now, or does it still linger every so often?
That's a great question. I wouldn't say it's gone completely, because obviously it was a very traumatic thing that affected not just me, but my family immensely. But everyone, me, I'm very close to my mum and my sister, we've all moved on now, which is really good. And I think that actually when you go through painful situations in your life, like everybody does, if you can draw strength from those moments where you were down, you go back and say, remember how you felt then, remember how angry you were, remember how upset you were then. But if you learn from it and try and then just use that as a motivation in the things you do now in the present, it can actually be a really good thing to be able to do, because you can just motivate yourself when you're feeling a bit tired or you're a bit nervous about something. You draw back on experiences in the past to help you in the future. And that's what I try and do all the time with my mindset, and I think without a doubt that's helped me in achieving what I have done, not just on the pitch but off the pitch as well. So it's great to be in the place that I am now, and I feel very, very fortunate, very, very lucky.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, that you can always draw strength from something like that, and it can always be kind of the making of you as a man, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's whenever anybody goes through an experience like that, there's like a before and after. It could either be defined by what happened, the horrible thing that happened to you for the rest of your life, or you can go on and make something new of your life. And I think that's what hopefully people find nice about my story, is that I could have just lived my whole life in being upset, looking back and going, oh, I can't do this because of this, because of that. But I've actually, in the end, it took a while, mind you, but in the end, I managed to just move on from that and see opportunities out there and not live with a tunnel vision and see, well, actually, be open-minded to that, try that, give that a go, and you never know what could come of it. Like public speaking, for example, I did that. I first started doing that a few years ago. And I remember the first time I did it, and I was sweating and my hands were shaking and I was really nervous. And now I've managed to progress with that. Same with coaching, same with playing now with football. I'm way better now on the pitch than I was a few years ago. And it's just all down to giving it a go and not giving up and believing in yourself. And that's what I try and do on a daily basis.
Yeah, and with regards to believing in yourself, just kind of want to move on to captaincy, because of course you're England captain. What does it mean to you, and how does it feel to kind of perform that role and that leadership aspect of it?
It is, well, obviously it's a huge honour. You think about the other England captains that have been in disability football, in the women's game, in the men's game. They're just such high profile, inspiring people. So after my first tournament in 2013, to be named captain straight away was a dream come true, and it really helped me mature quite a lot, and it really helped me to think about other people. And I think that's one of the reasons why I went into the work that I have done, trying to help others on their journeys too, because I was quite selfish, I think, before, and quite closed-minded. And now I'm a bit more open-minded, I'm more of a team player, and I try and help others as much as I possibly can do. And I think the captaincy has helped me mature with that. And also, it's helped me as a player, I think, as well. I'm not trying to do it all by myself. I'm not only thinking about myself, I'm thinking about the whole team, the whole squad, and the whole of CP football to try and build it and make it bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's just given me a responsibility that I actually enjoy. Obviously, there's pressure that comes with that. I mean, the Paralympics was, you know, it's huge. So we captained the GB, it was quite a lot of pressure, and I just captained England, the World Championships in Argentina. But, you know, it's something that I actually really, really enjoy. And when I'm captaining such an amazing group of players that I do, you know, it makes me very, very proud. It makes my family proud, and my friends and family proud. So it's just an amazing honour to have, and I hope to continue as captain for as long as possible, really.
Absolutely. Was you say that you felt you were quite selfish in the past. Was leadership easy for you to kind of work around, or was it something that you had to develop and grow into?
I think I've always been a natural leader, as in, you know, I've been quite vocal. You know, when the going gets tough, normally I'll be the one who stood up and, you know, managed to make a good pass that led to a goal or score a goal or put in a good tackle, which motivates the other players. But I've always had that in me. But I think I didn't have understanding for other people and what they might be going through. And if they're struggling, then maybe be a bit sort of compassionate and nicer to them. Don't drill people and hang them out to dry. And other players who are on the bench who aren't playing, you know, you've got to sympathy for them because they're upset. And I'll be like, oh, what are you moaning about? You need to just get back in the team. But actually, there might be more to it than that. And I've just understood that other people are going through their own little battles and their own little things. It's not just all about me. And as soon as I realised that, I found that I was more at peace with not only my teammates, but myself as well. So I think that's really, really helped me.
Absolutely. And I suppose this can be related to the leadership aspect as well. You mentioned the motivational speaking there. And also your own skills school too.
Yeah.
Let's start with the speaking. Obviously a daunting thing to do for a lot of people.
Definitely.
What was it that kind of convinced you that this is where you wanted to go? And again, was it an easy thing?
It wasn't an easy thing. I think I've always been fairly confident. So like talking and stuff like that, it's not been, you know, an issue apart from obviously when first time I had injury, I did used to forget words and stuff like that. But as soon as I met Alistair Heselton from the England team, he's an ex-player now, and I found out about, he was doing work for the Dame Kelly Holmes Trust, doing mentoring, and he was sharing his story and doing public speaking. I was just like, I think I'd want to have a go at that, because I wasn't working at all at the time. So I remember doing a talk for the FA, where it was just like a Q&A, you know, quite an easy one, where, you know, I had time to think about each answer, and it was my first sort of gig, and I did quite well at it, and someone approached me from the Dame Kelly Holmes Trust to do some work, so I couldn't believe my luck, and then I just went on a few training days with them, and then my confidence grew, and I've just given it a go, and just got better and better at it. And, you know, you may as well, if you've got an experience which can help others, you may as well share it and try and help them, because, you know, everyone, a lot of people want to be a footballer. And if you have that taken away from you through no fault of your own, but you managed to come back from it, I guess it's a decent story to be able to tell people. So I just enjoy trying to help others now through my story, and I hope to get better and better at it. And I always watch videos on YouTube, public speakers. I always watch managers when they do interviews and stuff like that, to try and draw inspiration from them and learn off them. And I just want to get better and better at it and do more and more and more, because I really, really enjoy it now.
And I suppose that's kind of the same kind of idea that you had with regards to the skills school, which you obviously provide coaching and workshops and things like that. What's the reaction been to, you know, kids that you've worked with through that?
It's been really good, really good on the whole. I thought that, you know, I've developed a few skill sets now, so running sort of team building activities, doing a bit of one-on-one mentoring, do some coaching, do like a motivational assembly. So I've got a few sessions that I do now that are quite well received, and I've had some decent feedback from. So I thought, why not have a website where people can book me in from? It's a bit more professional than sort of, you know, someone maybe trying to get my number off a friend or Facebook messaging me or Twittering me. And when they can actually go on my website, have a little bit of backstory to my life, and then they can book me in for whatever workshop they want. And it's actually worked pretty well. Obviously, it's not rapidly taken off quite yet. I think I need to build myself up a little bit more. But the work I have got has been brilliant. It seems to be well received by the kids. They're all buzzing at the end of a session, which is exactly what I want to see. And you get stuff like, you know, you've inspired me today, or I've learnt about respect today, or I've learnt to be a team player today, or you've given me belief in my life today. When you hear that from a little kid in primary school, it just melts your heart. Exactly what I want to do now, as much as possible, is try and help not just that sort of age group, but secondary school age, college kids, university kids, because it's not an easy world out there. There's loads of issues going on. There's loads of people going through, you know, terrible things. And if I can just have a small impact on one or two people every week, then that for me is a dream come true. And I feel like I've really landed on my feet with my career now. And I hope that I can continue to do this, continue to learn, continue to get better at it, so I can reach even more people throughout the UK.
Absolutely. And I suppose you've become a real role model, you know, to kids, to college students, etc. Is that a strange thing to get your head around, that you've become this person to look up to for so many? Because if you just look at some of the comments on, say, some of the YouTube videos that you've done, there is nothing but praise.
Yeah, it is overwhelming sometimes. It does really get you a little bit. It gets me a bit emotional. My eyes start glazing over sometimes when people say nice things to me, because of course it's nice when people say things like that. That's why you put in the work. But it's just one of those things that you just got to try and take in your stride, and not get, you don't want to get like an ego because of it, or you don't want to get too arrogant because of it. It should give you confidence, which it does do to me, but you shouldn't get carried away with it, because it's really nice to have that impact, but you want to continue on the same path you're going on. You need to stay motivated. You need to keep your feet on the floor and stay humble. And actually, in the end, the more praise I've managed to get, and the better I've done, it's actually made me more humble than I was before. And everyone's noticed that, my friends, my family, people I've worked with. And that for me is a nice thing to be, because I don't want to keep achieving more and more and stay as a nice person, stay humble, because there's nothing worse than having a bit of success and letting it go to your head, and then, you know, no one likes you anymore and no one wants to be your friend. So I want to try and stay humble and stay the person that I am, because that's the reason why I've achieved what I have.
Exactly. And let's move on to sort of the competitive aspect of CP football as well. You mentioned the Paralympics before, where I think GB came fifth in that at Rio. And also, relatively recently, last couple of weeks, there was the World Championships and you came fourth. Is that a real measure of how the team is growing competitively, and, you know, that success? You can really harness it to get more people involved.
Yes, definitely. I mean, when I first joined in 2012, 2013, we finished seventh in the Paralympics, and then in my first tournament in Barcelona, we finished ninth. And that was probably a fair reflection on actually where we were. So it's quite far down the pecking order. But since the Euros in 2014, where we had a new manager come in Keith Webb, and he really sorted out the tactics and our defensive play. He made us hard to beat. We started to get some more players in. The profile of the sport started to build. It just suddenly just took off. And we were just getting better and better. And we started instead of playing against the likes of Ukraine, Russia again, you know, battered sort of 5-6, 7-0, we were staying in the game with them, we were giving them good games, and then we started to build confidence with that. We drew actually with Ukraine in the Euros 1-1, our best result in our history probably, really. The last time we played against them, we lost 7-0, and everyone just looked at each other in the change room at the end of the game and said, sure, we're actually disappointed here, we've just drawn against Ukraine, we're a minute away from winning the game. And I think that was a massive point where we realised as a nation, as an England CP team, that with the talent that we have and with the training base at St George's Park, with the staff members that we have, we can really, really go far. And just over the time, we've added more players in. We've now got our new manager with Andy Smith, and he's playing a lot of attacking football. And in the Paralympics, we were desperately unlucky against Brazil and Ukraine not to get a result against either of those two to go through to a medal match. But then again, we bounced back in the World Championships. As you said, a few weeks ago in Argentina, finished fourth, highest finish in the history of our sport. We should have beat Iran in the semi-final. We battered them. We absolutely battered them. But we just couldn't score, and they did. That's elite football. And then we went to extra time with Russia, who were the best footballing team in CP football. Professional athletes get paid to do it. And we took them to extra time. We're 3 minutes away from penalties. Unfortunately, they managed to score. But, you know, we beat America 2-1, Japan 11-0, Venezuela 9-0, Holland, who haven't ever beaten a major competition before, 5-0. So we had some really good displays. Everyone took part in the tournament. People were coming off the bench and making an impact. People were coming off and making an impact. It was just a joy to be around. And I think this is the stepping stone now for us to go and win medals and eventually over the next few years become in the top three, if not, I would say, the best team in the world. That's how good we can be, I think.
Is that's the ambition then, to become the best?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, we're in and around there against Ukraine. He won it. We're losing by the odd goal or drawing with them. We've just taken Russia almost to penalties. Iran, we should have beat. Brazil, we should have beat in the Paralympics, and they actually finished seventh in the last competition. So there's no reason why we can't. With the, given the age group that we're, the age of our players, average age, I think 24, 25, continuously to train at St George's Park, hopefully train more now, get a bit more funding towards that. There's no reason why we can't keep challenging and eventually become one of, if not the best teams in the world.
Is that then one of the things that you kind of credit for the improvement of the team, better talent, better coaching, and the facilities at St George's Park? Is that combined all really helped you grow and get better?
Yeah, you need all of that to create a good team environment, to improve, to inspire people to play. For instance, if you get someone to come in for a trial who's maybe used to mainstream football and has more of a mild condition, they won't want to stick around if, you know, the standard's rubbish and the pitches are rubbish and the coaches aren't very good and you don't get fed or stay in a nice place. But there's no excuses with our England team, because we have, when we train, have everything you could ever wish for. We have, you know, full set of track suits and training gear and England gear, England kit to wear. We stay in a Hilton hotel. We get amazing food, amazing coaches, A-licensed coaches. You can't ask for any more. So it's a great environment to be in. I think that's one of the reasons why we've got better and better. And things like FATV and other media outlets are really promoting our sport now, so that more and more players are finding out about it, not just at an elite level, but more and more players are playing in grassroots stuff, in our talent hubs. And the cerebral palsy football is getting bigger and bigger, and there's getting more and more teams now. And if you improve grassroots, it's only going to improve the top level. And I just want everybody with a disability, not just cerebral palsy, given a chance to play. And the FA are really backing that now and getting and funding it and getting involved in it now. And it's really, really good, because everyone deserves a chance to play football.
Absolutely. And another thing that's relatively recent as well, that people may have seen on Twitter, is that you ended up winning a Pride of Birmingham award. I think it was at the end of September. That must be quite an accolade to have that to your name now.
Yeah, it's a huge honour, because I spent sort of 8 years going up to Birmingham, travelling up there, you know, four times a week from the age of 10, and training hard and representing the city to the best of my ability, playing full-time for them, dreaming about playing on that St Andrews pitch for the first team in the FA Cup or in the Premier League or something like that. And so obviously when I lost the opportunity, it was sad, but to be then recognised by the city, to obviously appreciate what I've managed to do with my England CP team and the work that I've done, was obviously another dream come true, a really nice accolade. And that I said it on the night, but that award was obviously really nice for me. But that's for the people who have never sort of given up on me and always believed in me. it was easy for people to sort of say, oh, you know, we'll leave Jack alone now. He's not going to maybe achieve anything now. But my family and a few friends always stood by me. They pulled me up when I was down. They believed in me. And that award was for them and for the city of Birmingham for being such an amazing city and giving me the opportunity to play for a truly amazing club for a number of years. So thank you to the people who awarded me that award, and thank you to my family and friends who always supported me.
Absolutely. It's always something that needs and deserves a mention, is always the support group around someone, because it's never just an individual thing when you succeed.
No, I mean, I couldn't have done anything on my own. I'm not going to sit here and say I did it all myself. You know, there's so many people to thank, you know, my teammates, CP Football, all my people I work for, my friends, my family. Without all of them, I couldn't have achieved what I have done. So it's not just a one person thing. This is a group effort, and I thank all of those people.
Exactly. And one last thing before we wrap up. With regard to CP Football, what competitions can we look forward to see in the future?
We have the European Championships next year in July in Holland. So there'll be no Iran who beat us in the semi-final, no Brazil, just European countries. So we've got to be going there to at least get top three, if not get to a final. That's what we would be aiming to do. So that's the next one. We then have a World Cup. It's called a World Cup the year after. I'm trying to think where that is now. That's in Spain. So a chance for us to play in a World Cup. And then unfortunately, we're not in the Paralympics anymore, Paralympic movement at the moment, which is a great shame for 2020. But we'll have to see what happens with that. But they're the next few competitions we've got coming up. So big competitions, and we hope to do as well as we can in them, as always.
Exactly. And the determination is there, which is always half of the battle.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, perfect. And with that, I suppose we should finish up. And I just want to say thank you once again, Jack, for coming on and sharing your story. It's truly inspirational path you've taken.
Thank you for asking me to come on.
Oh, absolutely. And you've also proven yourself to be a proper gentleman throughout all of this. So many thanks, and all the best for whatever's coming up in the future.
Thank you, Alistair. I really appreciate it.
Many thanks again to Jack for taking part in that interview. Hope everyone enjoyed it. And we'll just take this opportunity again to direct you in the way of our social media pages. That is Sportspiel Pod, more on Instagram, Twitter, and on Facebook. And of course, you can send us feedback to our email address at sportspielpod@gmail.com. Anything you want to add on this delightful, not sunny day?
Well, it depends what format you're listening to us on, but you know, we're available, Sportspiel, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. So feel free to download and listen there. And I think next time we'll promise to talk about some more uplifting stories, because I think at the moment we've done a few not so nice ones.
Yeah, I think we'll put that in. It's going to be a bit tired of scandals, I think. We'll find something joyous to talk about next time round.
At least we didn't talk about drugs this week, which is a first.
Give it time. Probably return with drugs next week. Anywho, we're going to be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, have fun, everyone. Bye-bye.